Accession number 20456, reel 30.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 30. I think you were saying that the Chinese officers...
Yes, they were there, I suspect, as advisors. And I made damn certain nothing went wrong. I never heard them utter a word. They took notes. They didn't confer with anyone at the meeting. What they did afterwards, I wouldn't know.
Did they ever show any signs of content or discontent, or were they inscrutable?
Oh, yes. I mean, occasionally, if something ridiculous happened, they'd roar with laughter like the rest of us, you know.
What sort of ridiculous things happened?
Well, people would make silly remarks. Octopuses with bloodstained claws. I mean,
this is just the use of language.
And dancing, skeletons dancing on the graves of, you have no idea the strange things that we were called by the North Koreans in there.
Did the South Koreans indulge in similar outlandish language at all?
Well, no, because you see, the South Koreans didn't, because the South Koreans weren't allowed to talk either. It was all done through the senior officer, who was an American general. Mm. So you've got some good Americanisms thrown in too, you know. But not quite so descriptive.
Now, you mentioned that a number of things happened at other meetings, that there was a raid by South Korean Marines that caused some...
Oh, yes, that indeed. There were all sorts of little pinpricky raids, some of which we knew about, and others we didn't. And on one occasion, we were called to a meeting, we didn't know why. They didn't have to tell you until you got there what they called them. And in the middle of this, a dirty, great tank carrier thing appeared with an assault boat riddled with holes and blood and debris outside where we could see it. And we were told exactly where this had been caught, and how many people had been killed, etc. This was disgraceful. It was a breach of the armistice terms, which it was. And what are we to say about it? And the answer was we couldn't say very much because we didn't know. And this was the South Korean Marines who thought they'd be clever and take someone out, and it all went wrong.
Did you discover afterwards what they'd been trying to do?
Oh, sort of, yes, I think we did. They were given the most imperial rocket by General Bonesteel, they never tried it on again. But a lot of nasty little incidents like that could happen without your commanders-in-chief knowing.
You also mentioned the North Korean commando raid with...
That was a very serious affair. It was a whole sort of company's strength. Young, I think they were mostly officer cadets, they landed way down in the south, and they spread mayhem. And luckily, it was, again, the Americans played it very well. They absolutely put a news blackout on everything. The Korean press wasn't allowed to say anything about it. And the North Koreans were very mystified because they had no communications with them. And this was supposed to, encourage the whole of the mistreated South to rise against their brutal rulers. And this was where the North Koreans got it wrong. They really did think that South Korea was ripe for revolution and would join them, and they were wrong. We gave it about 2 months, I think, and we called a meeting, and we had film and slides, And we showed them exactly what had happened to these guys. And they were absolutely horrified. You could see it. I mean, for the first time, they realized how dreadfully wrong it had all gone.
Did any of those young officers escape?
About three or four, most of which joined our side.
They defected.
They defected. They never got back to North Korea. No one got back to North Korea, as far as I know.
You mentioned that there was involvement by the neutral powers, the Swiss, Swedes, Poles, and Czechs. How did you get on with them?
Very well. They were terribly nice. Once every 6 weeks or so, our neutrals, i.e. the Swiss and the Swedes, they used to actually live in Panmunjom. They had a lovely little camp of their own. They used to have a lunch party on a Sunday. And the Poles and Czechs would come over, not the North Koreans. We could exchange an awful lot of information through the Poles and the Czechs as to what was going on. And on one occasion, the Swiss and the Swedes were taken on a week's trip around North Korea, Pyongyang and the mines and various training centers and so on, and were able to tell us a great deal about what was going on in North Korea.
Do you remember what they said?
Oh, I mean, there were all sorts of interesting stories. There was one thing, they were taken to Pyongyang, built themselves an enormous opera house. And during the course of an opera, they put on an extremely anti-American term, whereupon the neutral nations, the four representatives, walked out. And that showed the North Koreans that, you know, there was a limit beyond which they, in decent hospitality, they should not go.
Now, you said there were lots of little incidents, pinprick incidents. Do you think that those were all planned, or were some of them accidental or inadvertent?
In the demilitarized zone, it was 3 miles wide, I think. Clearly, each side had patrols to make sure all was well. And from time to time, those patrols would clash. And shoot each other, blew each other out of the mouth. And there were one or two occasions where American helicopters flew in the wrong place and were forced down. One particularly naughty case where a young chap just having posted back from the States, his second posting for Korea, thought he would show off a bit and took a chum up. And since he'd been last in Korea, various things had changed, and he was over North Korean territory and was forced down, and there was a riot. He was unarmed, but there was a hell of a riot over that one, and quite rightly so. It was a breach of thorough discipline, you know, which is the sort of thing that last thing the Americans wanted to happen. Because it could blow up. That sort of minor niggle, yeah.
What sort of scale were the patrols you've just mentioned? How many men would be sent out?
I spent three nights up on the normal patrols, the four or five guys.
Were they all American or all South Korea?
They could be South Korea. They could be a mixture.
Did any of our soldiers ever get involved in going on patrols?
No, they were expressly allowed not to. They were not allowed in the DMZ.
How was the DMZ marked?
Huh?
How was the DMZ marked?
On our side, with an enormous wire fence, with lights, claymore mines. It wasn't an anti-tank obstacle, but it was an obstacle, so we thought, for infantry. But nevertheless, they managed to get through it from time to time in small parties.
What was the ground like in the DMZ?
on the East Coast rolling, and as you got in the centre, it got very high and very hilly. It's the finest pheasant shooting ever.
Were there any civilians living in the DMZ?
No. No. Totally cleared.
What was General Bonesteel like? What were his main concerns while you were there?
He was a marvellous chap. He was tall, good-looking, exquisite nails. His staff went in fear and trembling on him. He was an American engineer. He was a U.S. been at West Point, third generation regular soldier, been a Rhodes Scholar, knew a lot about the Brits, you know. He was a wonderful guy to work with. Very tough, but terribly... if it hadn't been that he'd been in place when the Prebois was done, I shudder to think what might have happened. If you had a MacArthur instead of a Bonesteel, you know, the face would have erupted. Bonesteel, he was the very nicest type of what I call American gentleman, you know. Absolutely charming and highly intelligent.
Did he report to the American ambassador or back to...
Oh, the command structure was very old. Okay, it starts with the president in Washington.
Yes.
It then goes, strange to relate, to the admiral commanding Hawaii.
CNC Pacific,
CNC Pacific, yeah. ThinkPak. And Korea was actually under ThinkPak.
Yes.
Yes, of course the ambassador came in, but the military training command was through ThinkPak. And on one occasion, for example, when we were flying up to an important meeting when the EC-123 was shot down, our general in his helicopter and the secretary of the meeting were in touch with ThinkPak with the latest instructions from Washington as we were flying up to the meeting.
Did the Joint Chiefs have a place in this command structure?
Did they who?
The Joint Chiefs of Staff.
They must have done. I imagine you say ThinkPak would get his instructions from them.
So presumably the chain of command effectively would be the president, the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington.
Yes.
And then ThinkPak as the theatre commander.
Yes, correct.
And then General Bonesteel as the Korean.
He had two jobs. He was the United Nations commander.
Yes.
He was also commander of the United States 8th Army in Korea. And so one was purely a national command, the other was the international one.
Were you strongly conscious of UN involvement?
Yes, because when we went to Panmunjom, we went under the UN flag. UN flag on the table.
Was there any UN political representative in Korea?
There were lots of UN representatives. Who they all were, I would not know. You had every form of agency you can think of helping the South Korean economy.
But I'm thinking in terms of a representative of
the
Security Council.
We had no one on the DMZ. We didn't have anyone in blue hats scurrying around the place. They wore national uniform.
You mentioned the Thai company and its extramural activities.
Yes.
And the General Bonesteel was anxious to curtail them. Why was he so worried about that?
Well, because it was in a direct breach of everything you can think of. We got diplomatic privileges in Korea, and that meant... we had access to duty-free goods, or goods at very reduced prices. And that was a privilege, you know, especially given by our various governments. And these guys were absolutely running rings around it. If you can imagine, see, first of all, the plane they were flying, okay, it had Thai Air Force colours on it, basically provided by the Americans. They were paid by the Americans, and they were taking the Americans for a ride in that. They were buying stuff up at reduced prices, using American aircraft to flog it around Southeast Asia, and making a nice thing on the side. And everyone knew it. Not very good for what you might call international relations if you have rules broken on a large scale.
I think you mentioned that General Bonesteel tried to stop it, but actually didn't manage to do so.
Because, you see, he was foxed by the diplomatic business that the Thais could withdraw their company, and people would point the finger and say, ha ha ha, you know, so much for the United Nations, you know.
So they could threaten the solidarity.
That's it.
You say that you went to visit the American battalion of the DMZ, and they had a command post in a watchtower. What was that like? What was the watchtower like, and what was in the command post? How was it set up and furnished?
Typical battalion command post. Your DMZ was defended. I mean, okay, behind the DMZ you had artillery you could call on if necessary. You had air you could call on if necessary. And you had armored reinforcements and things. And your battalion command post consisted exactly of that. It was a dugout, extremely well made, extremely heavily, with all the communications required to deal with a situation on the DMZ. The watchtower was just a watchtower. There were one of many where you would climb up and have a good view, because from time to time the searchlights would come on and, you know, you could see what was going on, or thought you could. It was rather like we used to have on the Northwest Frontier, really.
Were the American troops in the vicinity of the DMZ on a high state of alert?
Yes. The battalion on the DMZ was on a very high state of alert. I mean, weapons loaded, everything. Yeah. Yeah.
While you were there, was there ever a major scare that the North Koreans might be preparing to launch another full-scale invasion or a major incursion?
I can't remember it. No, I mean, we were always at a fairly high state of alert, in that after all, Seoul was only 30 miles from the nearest bit of the DMZ. They could have been there in a couple of hours if they'd tried. Certainly a couple of days. But I suppose, having been inured to this in Berlin, you know, sort of got used to it.
Used to the idea of being close to the enemy.
That's it.
Mm. And the enemy being unpredictable.
The enemy, yes, they weren't really an enemy. They were just people who might suddenly become an enemy in a couple of hours' notice. Yeah.
You said that sometimes the North Koreans were very angry and used very colourful and abusive language and were rather intimidatory or tempted to be intimidatory. Were there ever occasions when they were cordial and friendly in their attitude and conduct?
I wouldn't say they were cordial and friendly, but they could be relaxed. You could have a meeting where quite useful information was exchanged. I mean, I've never forgotten the helicopter thing. Well, they realised that they were dealing with a couple of idiots, obviously they were going to make the most of it and say, well, you know, these are the sort of people you're allowed to fly your helicopters and what training they received, and, you know, squeezing the most out of a rather stupid situation. They could be angry if, for example, you had that landing craft thing, which was a disgraceful operation. I mean, it should never have happened. And I think anyone would be angry with something like that happen.
Now, earlier on, you described how you had different sorts of relations with the East Germans on the one hand and the Russians on the other when you were in Berlin.
Yes.
Would the North Koreans have fallen on the Russian side of that division or on the East German side in the way they behaved?
They were quite different. Your Asiatic, when he assumes the character of being your enemy, you are a sort of non-person, you know, you're below consideration. And indeed, he will use words in talking to you with that in mind. You're scum, you know, not worth bothering about.
When you came back to England, you went out of the army.
Yes.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to being a civilian?
Well, not really, because I had an awful lot of other things to think about at that time. I suppose, yes, the answer has got to be yes. But my wife was dying of cancer. I had to look after her. And so one was, so many much more important things to think about, your own well-being, that really didn't matter. And then I suppose things fell into place. I think one of the things that strikes you is the number of things you had to do for yourself that you're almost like putting a stamp on a letter, silly little things, you know, that you had to think of.
You're out on your own.
Exactly. Exactly. You were no one to say, please, what do I do now? Yeah.